Brother and sister like school. Last year, they really liked their teachers. But this is the start of a new school year. Who will their new teachers be? Welcome back to Deep in Bear Country, a Berenstain Bearcast. I am your host, Phil Gonzalez, and if it seems odd that I'm doing a back-to-school book in February, it is. It's a little odd. However, it's Valentine's weekend, Valentine's Day. By the time this drops, Valentine's Day has come and gone. It happened yesterday. I mean, it's Valentine's Day while I'm recording this, but by the time the episode comes out, it will not be Valentine's. In any case, there's no Valentine's Day book this year because there's no Valentine's Day books anymore that I can find. I believe we've covered every Valentine's Day book available. I've had to skip a whole ton of books, by the way, because the next books up are a Easter book, there's a St. Patrick's Day book, there's a Mother's Day book, and a Father's Day book. Pretty much just skipping book after book after book until I got to this one, which is The Berenstain Bears, We Love Our Teacher. The Berenstain Bears, We Love Our Teacher from 2024. Not only from 2024, but from just a few months ago, 2024. And you'll know that this is 2024 by the end of the book because it gives you fairly ironclad proof that this book is actually set in 2024. This book also shatters some continuity stuff, it breaks some reality, it solidifies some reality, and it operates in very much the same way as the Berenstain Bears Big School Project did, which is, it's a book about the love of learning and about the appreciation of teachers that foster a love of learning. A love of learning for learning's sake, not learning towards a test, not learning towards a result, but simply a curiosity about the world around us and an ability to get your hands on the history and the science that makes the world go round. In a lot of ways, this is a reflection of the kind of schooling that our daughter Mitzi is currently enrolled in. And in fact, I just have to bring up the fact that they're studying she's in eighth grade. They're studying childbirth in class right now. They've watched multiple videos of people giving birth, and the instructor who's been brought in to teach the kids about childbirth brought in a human placenta the other day, and the kids got to like poke at the placenta and moosh around the placenta and look at the placenta, and as disgusting as that might sound to many of the listeners, it's real hands-on science. Like, this is a real thing. This is a biological thing that you can poke at, I guess, is how science works. I don't know how science works. I'm not a scientist, and I was never very good at science, but I appreciate the hands-on experience. And this book is very much about appreciating teachers who give you hands-on experience with concepts, makes history and science and the world a little less abstract so that you can understand. This is something that when you learn that the world is less abstract, and it is a very concrete thing that you can get your hands in, you learn that the world is something you can change. You yourself can change the world, can take action to do things to fix problems in the world. And that's really what the benefit of a good teacher is teaching you that you have a place in this world, that you are worthy of education, that you are worthy of enlightenment, and that you can get your grubby little mitts on things, mush them around, break them and fix them. As only another human being can do. So the Berenstain Bears, We Love Our Teacher. What is this book about? Well, let's get started. So as we heard up top, brother and sister are starting a new school year, and this is already where the continuity starts being affected, because brother and sister have had the same teachers pretty much the entire run of the Berenstain Bears. Teacher Jane, Teacher Bob. Brother has Teacher Bob. Sister is Teacher Jane. And they are great teachers. They love their teachers. But all of a sudden, we're getting into a new school year. We've touched on new school years before, right? The beginning of school, first day of school, things like that. This is the first time I believe we're getting advanced in years. Brother's going into fourth grade. He has a new teacher. I guess we're leaving our old teachers behind. We don't learn about sister's new teacher in this book. That might be for later, but this is very much about new year, new you, new year, new teacher. What's going to happen? And this is a real anxiety that I remember having as a kid. Like, you spend a full year of your life getting comfortable with a human being who is your teacher, and then all of a sudden you get thrown into a whole new situation, because new teachers don't just have new teaching methods. They have new peccadilloes, they have new problems, new qualms, they have new things they look for, they have a different set of values, they have a different way of running a classroom, they have a different way of choosing, you know, they may or may not choose favorites, they may or may not even like you. And some teachers are very bad at hiding that. That was a thing that we experienced a lot when I was growing up. There were teachers who just played favorites, who played not so favorites. And that's an anxiety that kids have going into this. And you can reassure them as a parent that it's not something to worry about. Teachers can't play favorites. But we know as kids that whether or not you like your teacher will play a huge part in how your full year goes. And we had teachers as a kid, we had teachers in elementary school, that not teachers that I personally had, but teachers we knew about, who were not that great, who we would hear yelling at their classrooms. I'm talking like third grade, and we'd hear teachers, one particular teacher, like screaming at her class, like for not writing letters properly. Or there was one teacher I remember who was extremely biased against the boys in her class, and I remember that she like you, and you might think like, well, that's, you know, fine because the boys had a lot of advantages anyway, and we did, like, but to a degree where like she would openly mock and punish the boys in her classroom. And I remember once she walked past our classroom, we were playing some sort of game like Jeopardy or something, some educational game, and she leaned her head in and she goes, "Come on, girls, beat those boys." And we were all confused because that's not the way the teams were divided. Like, our teacher did not gender the teams. They were you know, chosen at random or whatever. But we all started assuming, I guess that's how she does it in her classroom. She must have divided the class in half by girls and boys and had the girls versus the boys, and then biased the girls against the boys and the boys against the girls. I don't know. I believe in my heart of hearts she was trying to help, but I also believe in my heart of hearts that she was doing nothing but harm, because she was perpetuating stereotypes and gendering her classroom and setting kids up against each other. It was wild. So we did not have that teacher. I was very happy about that. But if you get stuck with a dud teacher, you could end up with a dud year, I guess is the point I'm making. A brother and sister have that anxiety, and that's where we are starting off this book. We're going into the anxieties of a new teacher. It's not even what this book ends up being about. This book ends up being about an awesome teacher because they love their teacher. That's the title of the book. In any case, brother has a new teacher. Her name is Ms., M-I-Z, Ms. Barely. She's barely there. I don't know. That's all I can come up with. Ms. Barely. Brother's worried because Ms. Barely looks like a grump. She's all business. She's got her half moon spectacles on. She's got a scarf. She's got a skirt. She's got a sweater. She's got a headband and a pencil behind the ear. This bear means business. Welcome to fourth grade. It's Ms. Barely. Seems a little grouchy. Seems a little grumpy. Will brother even like his new teacher? Coming in behind brother, walking into class, looks like we got Queenie McBear. Right behind her is cousin Fred. What's going to happen? I want to talk about Ms. Barely here for a sec. She's got a skeptical look on her face. She's got the DreamWorks cocked eyebrow. She's smirking at her student. She's got a few books on her desk. She's got a mug full of pencils and pens. She's got a clipboard. Her arms are crossed. Her legs are crossed. She's standing there kind of leaning against her desk. She looks skeptical. She looks like she's looking at these kids and she doesn't know what... She looks like she's got a little anxiety about the year, by the way. Because if kids are affected by the teacher they have for the full year, you can guarantee that the teacher is worried about the crop of kids who are coming in. Now, Ms. Barely is an unknown quantity. She must be a new teacher at the school because the kids have never heard of her. They don't know anything about her. They haven't heard word one about Ms. Barely. It's a new name. It's a new teacher, new face. So we have two factions. We have the kids and we have the teacher coming in at each other. They're both worried about how things are going to pan out. How are things going to pan out? Let's find out. Is she a grump? Is she a grouch? Well, she calls their names, and right off the bat, we've got another wild continuity thing. So for years, people have asked me. Phil Gonzalez, they ask me. No one's ever asked me. But Phil Gonzalez, they ask me. What is going on with brother and sister's names? Are they really brother and sister, or like Mama and Papa? Are those just nicknames they were given a long time ago and they've stuck? They've stuck around town, they've stuck around school, they've stuck around their friends. We know that Mama and Papa are most likely named Ernie and Melissa from past experience. Berenstain Bears. They were looking through the photo album. They saw a picture of Mama and Papa from their high school years. They were known back then as Missy and Junior. We know that Papa is a junior, so we know that his name is probably Ernie, because we know that Grizzly Gramps' real name is Ernest. We know that Mama must be named Melissa, because Missy is usually short for Melissa. That's how I got to that point. Missy and Melissa and Ernest, that's the parents, but they're known as Mama and Papa. They're known as Mama and Papa around town because they were the first. They were our established bears. So are brother and sister really given names, but they're like their secret names? Who knows? We know now because the teacher's like, brother, what kind of a name is brother? Don't you have a real name? She doesn't say real name. Don't you have a name like Bill or Joe or Billy Joel? And brother's like, no, it's just brother. Huh. Says Ms. Bearley. And I want to call attention to this. So Ms. Bearley is not from around here. She's never heard of brother and sister. She's never heard of the Bear family, right? So she must not only be a new teacher at the school, she must be a new transplant to Bear Town. She's not familiar with the Bears. She's not familiar with how things work. All the other kids are like, yes, Brother Bear. That's brother. He's the brother. Once upon a time, he was Small Bear, but then he had a sister. Now he's Brother. So if Brother is his real name, don't you have a name like Billy Joel? He says, no, it's just Brother. She's like, He says it's just brother, which means that once upon a time, his name was legally Small Bear, or this was an agrarian culture at the time. They lived in a cave. They did not live in a town. But once upon a time, he was just Small Bear. Then they have a child. He's no longer Small Bear. He's Brother Bear. So they, at this point, when sister is born, they still don't seem to have neighbors, right? We've seen the Berenstain Bear's new baby. They still don't seem to have neighbors. Papa Bear goes off into the woods with Small Bear at this point. The mama is left at home. She delivers the baby alone by herself. So they don't have, like, there's no, they don't need names. Make sense? Like, they don't need names. They're Mama Bear, they're Papa Bear. But then this town seems to grow up around them, because at this point they've moved into the treehouse. Town grows up around them. Bears come in. Other animals with sentience come in. We know that. We know that they've been surrounded by animals who also speak. Neighborly skunk. Family of beavers, right? Rabbits try to move in at one point. Neighborly skunk doesn't seem to have a name. The beaver family doesn't really need names. They're isolated. They're the only ones of their kind in the area. They don't need proper names. However, bears move into the area. They have proper names, but the established bear family, known as the Bear family, in the area, mama, papa, and sister, brother, they appreciate each other. They've already established themselves. So the world builds itself around this bear family who have children named Brother Bear and Sister Bear. Make sense? Sorry, I just got freaked out for a second that my recorder wasn't recording. It is recording. And I'm also going to double check just to make sure. Yes. So I had to reset up my entire recording setup because I had to delete everything and start over from scratch. It's a long story. And I'm just terrified that I'm not actually capturing any of this. I am. And I'm glad, because this is gold, baby. This is gold, baby. This is a gold baby. This is like if you gave birth and the baby came out, but it was made of gold, not even a real baby. But you're like, gold baby. I can melt this down and sell it. Gold baby. That's what I think of my show as. It's a gold baby, a baby made of solid gold. So Ms. Bearley, outsider, unfamiliar with the conventions of bear world, bear town, bear country. She's not so sure about this brother bear. She's skeptical. And I like that. Because Stan Berenstain experienced this almost same thing in school. When he was in school, he was told that his name was incorrect. Remember that? Going way back when Stan Berenstain was in, I believe, high school, a teacher told him that he was spelling and pronouncing his last name incorrectly. That this teacher knew how Bernstein was spelled, and that he was doing it wrong. And I remember reading that years ago. I believe it was in Down a Sunny Dirt Road, their autobiography. And just being like, that stinks. Like, to have a teacher challenging your own personal name? That's ridiculous. That's negating a person's identity. That's attacking them at the core of their, like, history and family. That's attacking their name. Leave me my name, shouted Daniel Day-Lewis in the movie adaptation of The Crucible. No, said brother, it's just brother. And the teacher's like, And I understand that, like, this is like maybe a callback to those days when the teacher challenged another human being's actual name. It's his name. It's his brother's name. He's a brother boy. He's a boy. He's a brother. He's a brother. He's a boy. He's a bear. He's a brother. He's a boy. Brother Bear. In any case, that's not even what this book is about. But I do want to point out that his name is officially just Brother Bear. It's not Alan. So Ms. Bearley, we find out Ms. Bearley is a tough teacher. She gives out a lot of homework. Probably not necessary, Ms. Barely. By the way, homework, as we know, doesn't actually teach kids much. Mostly just busy work. Teachers, you can cut most of that homework unless the kids need to do some extra studying, in which case they might be able to do that during class time. Right? We know this. We know from tests and studies that homework, negligible as far as the impact it actually has on kids. Mostly just ruins their lives. Basically just ruins their lives and makes them hate school. But she gives out a lot of homework. She gives lots of tests, a little more important. She wants to make sure these kids are learning. It depends on what she does with these tests. Does she use these tests to improve her own teaching? Is she like, okay, most of the kids are getting this kind of stuff wrong, we got to focus on that? Or is she just using it to judge the kids, which is what most tests do? Remember, if you give a kid a test and they fail and you just fail that kid and you're like, sucks to be you, that's not good education. If you give the kid a test and you're like, okay, now we know where to focus on teaching you, that's a good test because you got to form a baseline and you got to see how you're doing as an educator. We don't do tests that way in school. What a test for kids should be is you should test the kids and then be like, all right, well, now we know this isn't going to impact your final grade or anything, because that's not important. What this is going to impact is how well I'm teaching you. And then you can give them that test again and see if they've learned it. That's what a test should, in any case. She gives a lot of homework. She gives a lot of tests. Is that good? We don't know. But she is. I do like it that Mike says she gives a lot of homework. She gives a lot of tests. But she is a good teacher. Even though she gives a lot of homework and tests, her ability to teach balances out those problems, is what I'm saying. So she's writing on the board. She's writing test tomorrow. And it's a whiteboard. It's not a chalkboard. Test tomorrow on our solar system. We can read a little bit of what she's writing. The solar system bound to the system of the something, and the biggest of such objects are. But then we have the sun. We have a list of the planets and everything. We have a list of the solar system. What comprises our solar system? We have the sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. We have the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. We have Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and then a cluster at the bottom. It says Pluto and other dwarf planets. So that's kind of how it works, is you have the sun, you have Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. Those are the inner planets. You have this massive asteroid belt. And if you flew through that massive asteroid belt, you probably wouldn't see an asteroid. They're very far apart. And then you have Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, which are the other four planets. And don't forget that Pluto is not considered a planet. It is a dwarf planet because there are so many planets that are the size of Pluto, that we would have just way too many planets in the solar system if Pluto was still considered a planet, because that's how categorization works, right? If Pluto's a planet, then all these others have to be planets, and that's just ridiculous. There can't be that many planets. So you have all this. Neptune, now the furthest away planet, not the coldest planet. Neptune gets pretty hot at times. We don't really understand the inner workings of Neptune, but we know that it gets very hot and gets hotter than some other planets. At times, I believe it gets hotter than the surface of Mercury, which is wild, or at least the exosphere, the stratosphere, part of its atmosphere gets hotter than Mercury at times. Neptune's a weird planet. In any case, they're studying the planets. They all look worried. Don't worry, kids. You got this. You got this. She's a good teacher. Why? Because she knows a lot. She knows about history and science. Those are the two things that she loves. She knows about dinosaurs and outer space, and she makes learning fun. And here's what we get. So she's wearing a space helmet. It's like a bubble helmet, like from a 1940s science fiction serial. Not a real space helmet, but it's a costume. She's dressed up like a space person. She's got a button on that says, I heart T-Rex. And she's teaching the kids about the Saturn V rocket, which is the rocket that went to the moon. She has a diagram of the rocket, or I should say Mike has drawn a brilliant diagram of the rocket with the command module, the lunar module, the third stage, second stage, and first, or I should say the first stage, the second stage, the third stage, the lunar module, and the command module. But what's fascinating is that next to it is a diagram she's either drawn or pasted on the board that says lunar landing mission. And it's this 10-stage mission that shows what is presumably the Earth and what is presumably the moon. And a numbered process of how the Saturn V went from the Earth to the moon. And it's labeled in such a way that you can see where it launched. There's the launch. You see it on its journey towards the moon. You see on steps 4 and 5 and 6 how it had to go around the moon and then come back around to the landing site. But then also how it, when it took back off, or took back, when like the, how did it work? Hold on, I've got this written down. So the Saturn V launched from Earth. Then that was the first stage. The lower section of the rocket provided the thrust to lift off. Then the second stage took over. The first stage is jettisoned. The second stage took over, pushing the rocket further into orbit. Then the third stage fired again to propel the spacecraft toward the moon. Then the part of the the command module is where the astronauts lived and controlled the mission. The lunar module separated from the command module and descended to the moon's surface. So the command module and the lunar modules, they separate from the final rocket stage once they're in orbit around the moon. The lunar module descends. The command module stayed in orbit, right? And then after the mission was done, the lunar module ascended, reconnected with the command module, and then the astronauts returned to Earth in the command module. The lunar module was left behind. And what we see in the actual diagram is that Once they take back off, they have to circle back around them to the back of the moon. They have to like circle around the moon again and sort of slingshot themselves back to Earth, right? And then land. I just love that this diagram is up there. They don't point it out. It's not like given a lot any attention in the story, but you can look it up. Like you can do a cut and paste of this image into a search engine, and it'll tell you what it is. Like it'll be like, oh no, this is the lunar landing mission set out in steps. So this is something the kids are probably having to learn, but Ms. Bailey is making that learning very hands-on, very fun. Like, oh wow, this is exciting. But it doesn't just end at spacecraft. She actually takes a hands-on interest in astronomy and has classes after dark. Elementary school after dark with Miss Bailey. She's doing a series. She's doing a serious astronomy class. She sets up a massive telescope, and invites the students and their families to come and look at things through her massive telescope. And it's late at night, and they all get a chance to look up at the moon, see the craters, see the rocks of the moon. We get a nice drawing by Mike of the surface of the lunar surface. The bears all get a chance to look at and identify like different types of rock, different impact craters, different places where rock has changed over the years, the dark spots of the moon. The cubs have a lot of fun. Apparently, the parents have a lot of fun. I don't know if this was voluntary, like if the kids had to come do this. I mean, I hope she gave them plenty of advance notice. Like, we're going to be doing a late night project after sunset. Please set aside that time so your children can come. Maybe it's an extra credit thing. Maybe it's just for fun. I don't know. This is also not set up at school. This is in front of her house. Now that I'm looking at it, does it say that? It says she has the class come to school after dark, but looking behind her, maybe that's a schoolhouse. I can't really tell. It could be her house. I don't know. In any case, everybody has a lot of fun. They're all looking at the stars. They're all looking at the moon. Again, she's showing the cubs this is something they can observe. She's showing the cubs that this is something you don't actually learn about. You don't have to learn about it in the abstract. You don't have to learn about it through books and pages. You can learn about it yourself. You can get a telescope and look at the moon. That's what astronomers do. Fascinating stuff. And if you can do it, you can change it. If you do it, you can affect it. So then they start learning about history. And part of learning about history is looking into the past. And part of looking into the past is looking at your community around you and learning how your community has changed over the years. We're the neighborhood I live in, Longfellow, very good at that. Longfellow has a neighborhood organization and is very tied into the history of this area. There used to be an amusement park where I live. The Longfellow used to be the site of this massive amusement park. It's very famous because, was it called Wonderland? Something like that. It was one of the locations of the original incubator babies, where the guy who invented incubators would show them at like as a sideshow attraction. He invents incubators, and he puts babies in the incubators, like preemies and stuff. And then you could pay money and come in and look at the incubators. It was the only way he could afford to show off these incubators and get people like interested in the fact that these are saving babies' lives. This guy saved. He and his team, they saved so many babies' lives through their little incubator sideshow exhibits. And yes, the babies were put on exhibit, but also it got professionals to look at these and go, oh my gosh, these are saving babies' lives. These babies, who normally wouldn't have had much of a fighting chance, are alive because of this invention, these things that keep babies warm and safe and protected from the elements. Fascinating stuff. And that was here. Like, we have the building where that happened, one of the buildings where that happened. Still exists. It's an apartment building right now in our neighborhood. But it's good to know the history. We have a local neighborhood newspaper run by one guy that just did a whole report on the history of neighborhood grocery stores and how those grocery stores still exist in our neighborhoods, but they've been converted into homes. And there's just tons of them. Like, at one point, there was this like grocery store boom where they built grocery stores all over the neighborhood because they wanted each like sort of set of blocks to have their own like industry and person who could provide food to them. And that didn't last, but these industry buildings that were built and on residential blocks still exist as homes. We've got a few. I believe on our block, there's a set of homes at the very end of the block that used to be a butcher and a baker and a grocery. And you look at them now and you're like, yeah, they look like they were businesses. Now they're houses. But they look like businesses, and it's just fascinating that that exists. So Ms. Barely understands this. She understands that history is all around us. The history of your community is just as important as the history of your nation, as the history of the world. You understand how your community grew and how your community came up. You'll understand more about the people around you. And so she takes them to a school trip to see an old water mill in their town. It's on the Bear River, like the river, the big river that flows through their community. And it's a water mill. We don't learn much about this mill. We see it from the outside. It's probably a grist mill, flour mill. It's a paddle, you know, has the paddle wheel that provides the power to the mill. Other classes and families come too, and the cubs see how things were made long ago. So they get to go into this mill. It's very small. We don't learn much about the inner workings of the mill, but we do see big wheels turning, and they're like, you know, the wheels are turning. They're connected by belts and other gears. It says brother cranks a crank. And I wanted to show you this because. So I tried to look up what the inner workings of this mill. And I did a lot of image searches. I did a lot of attempting to find out what's going on here. And I couldn't quite work out what Mike was drawing, particularly when it comes to what brother is doing. Brother is turning a crank that is attached to two gears, which, okay, but I couldn't find that in any, and this is me, like, I'm looking at layouts of mills, I'm looking at the parts of mills, the gears of mills, I'm looking at blueprints of mills, I'm doing my due diligence, I'm trying to figure out what, couldn't find it. Couldn't find anything related to this. I mean, there are hand cranks in some mills, but they're usually attached to like manual like grinding operations. Couldn't figure it out at all. Like what brother is doing. There didn't seem to be anything related. Because if you look up like hand crank grist mill, you're going to get a small hand cranked grist mill. You're going to get a portable mill. You're not going to get this thing. The gears are in the floor. Like one of the gears is in the floor. If you look at the layout of mills, they are complicated. You've got bands and gears and grinders, and you've got multiple things happening in a grist mill because it does multiple jobs at once because you only have this one paddle wheel as powering this whole thing. The thing is, sister's pulling on a rope. She's learning about levers and pulleys, which is handy. She's trying to lift a millstone. There's a millstone on the ground. It's a small millstone, but she's trying to lift a millstone. Using pulleys, she's actually getting it off the ground. And what you know that what Ms. Barely is doing is demonstrating pulleys, simple machines. Pulleys are good at like transference of work, effort, energy, into like a focused point to like take what you're doing and making it actually an easier job. It's a simple machine. So that makes sense. I just don't understand what brother's doing unless it's just set up for kids to learn. Like you turn the crank and you can actually move a much larger object because you're using like the lever system, the fulcrum, and you're turning a larger gear, which moves a smaller gear, but which can attach itself to other gears. Gear systems, levers, and pulleys, they're all simple machines, and a mill is a great place to learn about it. I just wish that Mike had explained it a little bit better for us. In any case, the Cubs are having a lot of fun. They're learning to hammer nails and drill holes manually. It's a lot of fun, and Ms. Barely knows it's a lot of fun. She looks a little smug at what she's teaching the kids. Because she knows they're learning. She knows that she's doing a good job. And she's a good teacher. Like, this is getting kids out there. And this is what Mitzi does in school, by the way. They go on, they have these like experience weeks where they go out to, they went, like they spent a lot of time at a water treatment plant. Mitzi got really fascinated by water treatment, like the ins and outs of water treatment plants. They learn a lot about this stuff by going to water treatment plants, talking to people who run water treatment plants. This was in like seventh grade. Fascinating, fascinating stuff. And she was able to like speak to the history of water treatment and speak about how water treatment works in our area and like how you test water and do water testing. Lots of fun. Lots of fun when you get to put your hands on it. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. That's what these cubs are doing. Gristmill or something. But here's the big one. Here's what I really want to talk about. Because Ms. Barely teaches her class about how things are made in today's world. And she brings in a friend. She brings in a friend who worked on planes for the Bear Air Force. All right. She has a friend who worked on planes for the Bear Air Force. This friend is done up to look like Rosie the Riveter. Not, and I'm gonna say this, and it's gonna be a controversy, but I want you to listen to me. Not We Can Do It. Not the We Can Do It lady, woman, worker. Rosie the Riveter. Rosie the Riveter and the We Can Do It woman are two separate characters, and I need you to understand that. Even though in popular culture, the We Can Do It woman is associated with the concept of Rosie the Riveter, it may as well be Rosie the Riveter at this point. Rosie the Riveter was a character created by Red Evans and John Jacob Loeb. It was a song called Rosie the Riveter that was really popular. It was 1942. During the war effort, women were working on the war effort because the men were being sent to the war. And so women were taking these factory jobs over because they were the ones who could do the work. And the concept of Rosie the Riveter was used as encouragement, as like, yes, we can do it. We can do this. The We Can Do It poster was strictly an internal thing for Westinghouse employees. Westinghouse was trying to keep its employees motivated. And so it had this whole series of We Can Do It posters, one of which was this strong woman. But it was corporate propaganda for its workers. The We Can Do It image was kind of forgotten about until the 1980s when it was rediscovered. It wasn't used a lot. That was the We Can Do It. It was just something that a worker would have seen on the wall. It was rediscovered in the 1980s and co-opted by the women's movement to much greater effect. But it was conflated with the concept of Rosie the Riveter. But at the time, that image was not referred to as Rosie the Riveter because the only people who knew about that image were the few Westinghouse employees who would have passed it every day, ignored it because they were going to their job. And we know that corporate, like, motivational material is completely ignored by the workers, no matter how well it's painted or done. So what we're seeing here is a conflation of Rosie the Riveter and the We Can Do It and other forms of, honestly, wartime propaganda used to encourage people to keep working, not stop working, and work for people who build weapons because we got to bust down the walls or whatever it is weapons do. I'm not trying to sound cynical about it. I mean, but it was propaganda at the time. But it also meant a lot to the women who were working because it was showing women as strong and capable, which they were. And then the men came back from the war and the women all lost their jobs because the men came back and they were like, what are these women doing in our work? Get rid of them. And they did. They got rid of them and put women back in the house and set the women's movement back again. Because that's the way the world works, I guess, is we make progress for a century. And then one person comes along and just undoes all of it, like someone untying a shoe, like pretty much as easily as somebody untying their shoe. A person comes along and is like, I don't like that this shoe is so nicely tied. Yoink. And they ruin everything. They just ruin everything. They ruin everything. Everything gets ruined. Things aren't, we can't have anything nice, can we? Can we have nice bombers? Yeah, well, let's take a look at it. Okay, so Ms. Barely brings in a friend. I don't know who this person is. Brings in a friend who worked on planes for the Bear Air Force. And we see a diagram behind her, presumably of one of the planes she used to work on. It's called a Bearcraft 17. Now, this thing is clearly, it's labeled, it's a four-engine bomber. It's got a dorsal turret, a cockpit, a chin turret, a propeller, engines, rudders, elevators. It's got a place for a tail gunner, a belly turret. This thing, everyone, is clearly meant to be a Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress. It's a Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress. If you look at it, if you look at the diagram of one, it's just what it is. It's just, that's just what it is. The chin turret, the dorsal, everything is in place. They've just taken the B-17 and called it a Bearcraft 17. It's funny. It's a joke. Haha, we're in Bear World. We know that World War II or some equivalent existed in Bear World. We've seen the uniforms. We've seen the parades. But the B-17 was a heavy bomber that was used during World War II. It was an amazing piece of engineering, craftsmanship. There's a few left in the world, but it was able to like fly for a long time, had long range. It was durable. It was flyable. And just bombed the crud out of people. They just dropped, it just bombed the heck fire out of people. It was a bomber. Now, what's interesting, though, is that if Miss Barely's friend worked on B-17s, that means that either Miss Barely's friend is in her late 90s or early 100s, or that the bear version of World War II happened much more recently in bear history, which makes sense because we get hinted at that Papa Bear was a veteran who fought in this war. And Papa Bear is not that old. So if Papa Bear fought in their equivalent of World War II, then their equivalent of World War II happened probably around the time of the Vietnam War, maybe the Gulf War. I'm not sure. We know that Bear World history keeps getting pushed forward, but the signifiers of Bear World history don't. So Bear World's World War II continues to look like our World War II, but it's taking place further and further and later in the timeline. So who is Ms. Barely's friend and how old is she? We don't know. She doesn't look 100 years old. But again, we don't know much about how bears age. So it's possible this story is set in an earlier time period, but we know that it's not. We know that these stories are contemporary. And by the end of this, we're going to know exactly what year it's set in, as you shall see. So she's probably in her 100s. It's notable, though, that while Rosie the Riveter was a made-up character, there were actual people who may have inspired Rosie the Riveter. There was Naomi Parker Fraley, who died in 2018. She worked at the Alameda Naval Air Station in California, where she helped build and repair military aircraft. There was Eleanor Otto, who was born in 1919, died in 2014 at the age of 95, who built aircraft for over 50 years. She worked at Rohr Aircraft during World War II and continued assembling C-17 cargo planes until she retired in 2014 at the age of 95. So she didn't die in 2014. I'm sorry. She retired in 2014 at the age of 95. May Cryer, who was born in 1926, who worked on B-17 and B-29 bombers at the Boeing plant in Seattle. She became an advocate for honoring the contributions of World War II women workers. And Mildred Crowe Sargent, was born in 1924, died in 2021, helped build military aircraft in Tennessee, and was recognized for her contributions to the war effort. Now, if Ms. Barely's friend worked on planes for the Bear Air Force and built planes that were basically the B-17s, she would have been in her late teens or early 20s during the Bear version of World War II. So she would have been born around 1915 to 1925, meaning she would be over 100 years old today. Again, timelines are weird. We don't understand. But what's awesome about this story is that Ms. Barely is using this not only to teach cubs about how things are built, how things are made, but to honor the real-life Rosie the Riveters, while making history accessible to her students. You see how that works? Like, she's teaching, she's honoring, she's showing kids, cubs in her cubs, people in their community, and she is making history accessible, showing that history is a real thing that affects real people. And if history affects real people, history can be affected by real people, which means you can change history. You can change the world. You yourself. Children, teens, young adults, adults, middle-aged people, older people, old people, people in their hundreds. You could change the world. You could still change the world. The world is still a changeable thing that you can change. If one person can untie the shoestring, then one person can tie it back. One person can change the world. Yeah. So that's kind of what Ms. Barely seems to be saying, seems to be doing, seems to be encouraging in her cubs. And her friend, who's never named, by the way, shows the class the tools she makes to use. Is she a ghost? Is this a real person? We never see anyone making physical contact with her. She brings in tools and stuff. She brings in riveters. Like riveters. She brings in a sheet of metal and teaches a cub how to rivet. Right? Like, it's really noisy, but it's lots of fun. She comes in. She brings objects. Is she real or is she a phantom? Is Miss Barely a necromancer who brings back creatures from the dead to teach her class? Is that the case? Is that what's happening? Is that what we're seeing here? Is that what I'm to learn? I don't know. But I will tell you this. It works. The kids have a great time. They learn about riveting. They learn how to make B-17 bombers in class. They're going to need them when the world goes to war again. When the draft is reinstated. And Brother Bear finds himself 14 years old, dug up in a trench. Wherever we've sent the children to fight and die. Because one person can pull the shoestring. In any case, here's how we know what year the story is set in. The year goes by fast. It's time for a break. So winter break, Christmas break is coming up. But they're looking at a calendar. December 21st, first day of winter, 23rd, winter break, 24th, Christmas Eve, 25th, Christmas, 26th, Kwanzaa, 31st, New Year's Eve. However, ho, 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 no pun intended. On the 25th, it also says first day of Hanukkah. Now, when was the first day of Hanukkah? On Christmas Day? Why, in 2024, my friends. Story takes place in 2024. We've nailed it. It's like right there. It's right there in black and white or full color. 2024. First day of Hanukkah was on Christmas. That's what happened this year. It was a wild holiday this year. We had a really late Thanksgiving, so we had very little time to get ready for Christmas. And then we're celebrating Christmas. And then that night, what happens? I went to go see Nosferatu. But what else happened? First night of Hanukkah. So, you know, that's how it works. It should say first night of Hanukkah on this calendar. But, you know, they did their best. The Cubs will be back soon. They will miss Ms. Barely because they think she's a good teacher. And they all fantasize about how awesome she is. She's a regular Ms. Frizzle. Let's just say that. She's a famous Frizzle. She's a Ms. Frizzle in reality. Like, how far can a teacher actually... A teacher doesn't have a magic school bus. But a teacher can have magic bus that'll take the kids to the mill. That'll take the kids to the B-17 plant. That'll take the kids to the Bearsonian Museum. They'll take the kids to the telescope. They want her to know that they love her. They want her to know that they think she's a great teacher. So they make her a big card. They make her essentially a Valentine. It's a big card with a heart with an arrow through it, covered in hearts. It's a Valentine, but it's not Valentine's Day to them. But the Valentine says, "We love our teacher," and it is signed by all the Cubs. And who are all the Cubs? Ladies and gentlemen, we get a list of every Cub in Brother's class. Right here on the card. It's right here on the card. Who are our Cubs? Brother, Millie, Fred, Anna, Sarah, Ted, Emma. You name your bear Ted. That's a movement. Teddy is the name of, I believe, brother and sister's, Lizzie's brother and sister, Freddie's new sister, right? That's Teddy. Is that how it works? I can't remember. Didn't they have a kid? Emma, Barry, Nora, Sammy, June, Susie. We love Susie. Ferdy, Milton, Harry, Linda, Queenie, and Bonnie. I don't see Ferdy's girlfriend. Who's Ferdy's girlfriend? Brunowitz. Trudy. Trudy Brunowitz. Don't see Trudy. Guess she moved. They give the card to Miss Barely. There's a tear in Miss Barely's eye. Well, she's a big softy. Goodbye, Miss Barely. See you soon. And that's it. The Cubs hug her. They're going to miss her over break. And she feels appreciated. And you know what? She should feel appreciated because she is a good teacher. They love their teacher. This is a book about just appreciating a solid teacher. Not loving every teacher. Some teachers walk past your classroom and say, "Come on, girls, beat those boys," and reinforce sexual stereotypes, gender stereotypes, reinforce the gender binary without even thinking they're doing it, thinking they're being cool. A teacher was not cool. Some teachers scream at their kids and say, no, that's not how you write an M. You're going up, down, up, down. You should be going down, 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 down. That's how you write an M. That's what she screamed at her kids. I remember this vividly. And I remember turning to my friend Nora and giving her a look like, ooh, those poor kids. Because the classrooms didn't have walls between them. They had those giant industrial, like, stiff curtains between them that you, like, pull aside to, like, separate. Because you could pull the curtain aside and have a giant classroom if you're going to watch, like, a movie together or whatever. Or have, like, a person who came in to talk. We didn't appreciate that teacher. I know her name, too, but I'm not going to call her out by name. She had curly hair. She had wild curly hair. And I also remember that about her. I remember more about her than I do about my actual teacher because she made an impression because she yelled a lot. Felt bad for those kids. But Ms. Barely did not yell. She was grumpy. She's a bit of a grouch. Gave too much homework. Gave too much test. But she taught the kids about Mill, about Rocket, about her 100-year-old friend. Maybe a ghost. Maybe a ghost. We love our teacher. We love our good teachers. Mr. Miller, fifth grade. He was a good teacher. My first male teacher blew us away. Ms. Johnson, my third grade math teacher, because we got separated out for math. We went to a separate math teacher. She was amazing. Amazing. She was the person who taught me that if a person asks you, can they do something? You are allowed to respond, I don't know. Can you? That was what she always said. Can I go to the bathroom? She would stop class. I don't know. Can you? May I go to the bathroom? She sends you on your way. She was awesome. We love Ms. Johnson. Had a lot of Ms. Johnson. Had a Ms. Johnson as a teacher. Had a Ms. Johnson as a principal. There were a lot of Ms. Johnsons. Don't know why. Common name. Loved those teachers. Ms. Wendland. She was great. Remember Ms. Wendland? She was great. Ms. Lukenhoff. My kindergarten teacher, loved Ms. Luganoff. She remembered my mom. She would run into my mom in public and know her. Be like, Gail. And she'd be like, oh my God, I ran into your kindergarten teacher. She remembers me. Ms. Luganoff, love you to death. Great teachers. We love our teachers. We love good teachers. They make you feel like you're part of the world. They make you feel like you can change the world because you can change the world. Don't forget that. You can change the world. We need good teachers. Keep fighting the good fight. Keep teaching the good teach. Keep kidding the good kids. And I'll see you all next time deep in Bear Country.